Hi, this is Barry Liss at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science and Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. When you make an online purchase, are you concerned how the data you provide the merchant will be used? Are you willing to pay for your online privacy? In today's segment, we talk to Dr. Alessandro Acquisti of Carnegie Mellon University's Hines College. He's co-author of The Effect of Online Privacy Information on Purchasing Behavior, an Experimental Study, which appears in the INFORMS journal Information Systems Research. He wrote the study with Janice Tsai, Serge Eagleman, and Lori Craner, also of Carnegie Mellon. Professor, welcome to the Science of Better.
Hi, good evening. Nice talking to you.
I have a friend who's a market researcher, and this friend refuses to open a page on Facebook because of privacy concerns, although he's willing to start and have a page on LinkedIn. How representative is he of the public and its concerns about privacy on the Internet?
Well, your friend is certainly not alone. However, perhaps one may say he's one of a dying breed, in that if you look at the data, it seems that there always have been approximately three categories of people in terms of concerns toward privacy. Those who say, my life is an open book, I have nothing to hide. Those who are pragmatists and like privacy, but they understand that they need to reveal information to function in a modern society. And then the fundamentalists who believe that privacy is an important right and government or organizations do not have a right to know too much about us. But this last group, in a way, is becoming smaller, perhaps also because of the impact of Internet, social media, Web 2.0, and so forth.
Is there a sense, either from this one of these groups or from the general public, that the right to privacy is under serious threat?
Yes, many people still believe so, but then again, they have been believing that for many, many years. If you look at the studies done by one of the most senior and probably most famous researchers in this area, Alan Westin. Alan Westin started doing surveys of privacy attitudes back in the, I believe in the mid-70s at least. He would ask questions such as, do you believe your privacy is under threat? And many people would answer yes already back then. If anything, things have gotten worse now in terms of how much of our personal and professional lives are being monitored. So, yes, Americans still believe that privacy is under threat, and they still use Facebook every day.
So there's the contradiction. And what is the fear that online merchants will do with information they acquire? What kind of information do merchants obtain over the course of either a single transaction or a relationship with a customer?
Right. When it comes to privacy fears, I like to distinguish between two different emotions or concerns. One is about practical usages of the data. Some consumers fear maybe price discrimination. Being offered goods at a different price, at a higher price than the next person, because the merchant knows too much. Some other consumers may fear spam. Some other consumers may fear identity theft. Your data goes to a merchant who is hacked, and then your data is used for your identity. But then there is another level of fears which are less practical, less connected to something specific, and more in terms of people like to have control on their personal information, and when they feel they are losing that control, even if there is no objective cause to that, they feel nevertheless uncomfortable.
One way that people can restore their confidence is to check on privacy policies on the websites that they visit. How do people feel about simply doing that?
Almost no one does it. And by does it, I mean almost no one reads privacy policies. In fact, many of those who claim do are lying. In the sense that when you compare data from surveys about have you ever read a privacy policy, and or recently a privacy policy, and you compare the data to actual behavioral clickstream data about the percentage of visitors to a website who have clicked on the link to the privacy policy, you can see that the small number of people who claim they've read them becomes even smaller when you see the number of those who actually did click on links. And I cannot blame people for not caring about privacy policies. They are long, not so easy to understand. They are written more to protect the website than to protect the consumer. So in a way, I would call these, to take a term from another field of research, rational ignorance, in the sense that it is actually rational to become ignorant by not clicking on the privacy policy, because you have little to learn of useful from them.
Just as with bank statements, which are known for being in very small type and extremely lengthy and written in very legal, difficult to understand language.
Right. That's the case.
I understand that there's a long-standing debate about whether the protection of private information can be leveraged as a selling point online, talking now from the perspective of the merchant. How do the arguments go?
Well, the conventional wisdom and the most prevalent argument is that people will not pay for privacy ever. And I do admit that there is some evidence that may lead us to believe that that's the case. Privacy-enhancing technologies, most of them have failed in the marketplace because very few consumers were willing to pay cash money for them. On the other hand, maybe that argument is too extreme. Maybe under certain conditions, people will pay for privacy. And in a way, this is what motivated our, this question motivated our study.
And, of course, this brings us right up to discussing your study. And what did you seek to find out with your research?
In a way, and not casually, I believe, our study is connected to your last two questions. One, the issue of long, difficult-to-understand privacy policies, and two, the issue of people will pay for privacy. So we wanted to see whether if you present the information about the way a merchant handles consumer data in a very simple and accessible way. So if you make that information very easy to use for the consumer, will consumers pay attention to it and in fact act on it to the point that they will privilege a merchant who is more privacy protective than another merchant, even though that merchant may perhaps charge a little bit more for a product than the next merchant? This is what we tried to study, and we did so using a controlled lab experiment with randomized conditions, and we found eventually that the answer was yes. In some cases, people will pay for privacy.
Before we get on to your broader conclusions, I thought, since your paper is rather elegant in its simplicity in terms of the way of describing the way you did your study, perhaps you could explain the two phases of the study, the survey and the experiment.
Yeah, broadly speaking, and not considering the pilots we ran, the experiment consisted in two steps. There was a survey and then the actual lab experiment. The survey was with a different sample subject than the experiment, and the goal of the survey was to, well, we actually had two main goals. One, to have a good sense of what things people care about when they purchase online and what aspects of a merchant they do not care about, and also what kind of items they feel more or less comfortable purchasing online. And then we used this information in the second part of the study, which was an actual experiment in the lab.
You used a search engine that I've never heard of before. What is the Privacy Finder, and what icons does it provide to consumers to make website privacy a little bit more understandable?
Right, so Privacy Finder was actually developed independently of our experiment. It's a, basically, you can consider it as a search engine, or better, as a service which can run on top of other search engines, such as Google or Yahoo. And what it does, it mines information about websites, and in particular, it looks for so-called P3P, information which refers to machine-readable privacy policies of the merchants, so that when you're searching for certain information, maybe you're searching for Microsoft, or maybe you're searching for a product, for some batteries, and the search results pop up, either from Yahoo or Google, the privacy finder adds on the screen, on top of those results, some icons representing the level of, let's say, privacy friendliness of the various sites which have been returned in answer to your search query. Therefore, you as a user are able to, even before clicking on a given link, you're able to know which of these sites is more or less privacy friendly, is more or less congenial to your own privacy preferences.
And it's a simple rating of boxes of 0 through 4, as I recall.
That's true. So the privacy finder went through a number of different designs and approaches. The current one, which seems to be a good compromise between simplicity and with still the ability to capture relevant information, is based on a set of icons. So 4 green icons represent the highest level of privacy protection. 1 icon is the lowest. No icons whatsoever means that the system has not been able to find any machine-readable information about the privacy policies of the particular website.
Moving on to your study, in the first part in the survey, what did you find were the most pressing types of online privacy concerns among the people that you surveyed?
We actually did 2 things. First, we tried to look for what aspects of a merchant our subjects were most concerned about or interested in when they were going to purchase something online. And next, we check also things related to what specific privacy concerns our subjects had. For the first question, what are the aspects, characteristics of criteria of a merchant which were most important to our subjects? Price was the top item, but privacy was very, very close to the top. Instead, handicap accessibility was one of the criteria or characteristics at the bottom. I will explain later why I'm talking about handicap accessibility. It was something that, I guess, one of the clever aspects of our experimental design, we used that as a control condition. In terms of privacy concerns...
There were a number of clever aspects to your study, but please go on.
In terms of privacy concerns, they, in a way, I mentioned them earlier when I was referring to the fact that some people worry about privacy discrimination. Some worry about spam, some worry about identity theft, and some other worry simply about the fact that they lose control on their data.
Using this, you went on to construct an experiment which was very carefully done and very neatly constructed. And how did you construct the experiment that was a follow-up to the first part of the study? Please go through some of the elements of the experiment.
Well, this was a randomized between subject conditions experiment. So we had 3 conditions to which we randomly assigned the subjects who came to our lab. All the subjects were told that their task was to test this new search engine. They were told that some of the tasks would involve looking for information with the engine, and other tasks may involve looking for products to buy through the engine, and finally even purchase some products found through the engine. And what varied across the 3 conditions was the kind of information that would appear on the screen of the subjects as they were searching for information or they were searching for products. Unknown to the subject, we were actually controlling what information they would see. And in fact, we would use in some of the conditions the information coming from the privacy finder, so that in one condition, when our subjects arrived to the point of the experiment in which they were asked to find certain products to purchase online, such as batteries, in the condition they would find, after searching for a specific type of batteries, a list of merchants, and they would see the prices of the merchants, but not much else. in another condition, they would also see the icons coming from the privacy finder search engine, but they were told that these icons represented the level of handicap accessibility of the given merchant. And we chose handicap accessibility precisely because it was of no real importance to the vast majority of the subjects. So,
as you had determined in the first part of the survey.
Exactly. So we were using this as an additional control condition to see whether subjects reacted to icons even if they had no real meaning to them, or only reacted to icons when they had an important meaning to them. An important meaning was the third and last condition, where the icons actually represented the level of privacy friendliness of the different merchants.
It's not uncommon for studies to use monetary rewards or other types of rewards for participants. What were the monetary incentives that you used, and how did you keep your subjects from gaming the system rather than making purchases that would help you understand privacy concerns?
This was indeed one of the most important aspects of the study, because our goal was to see, as we discussed earlier, whether people will pay for privacy. So we selected merchants who were selling the same type of good at different prices, slightly different prices, maybe differences of 10, 40, 50 cents, and also with different privacy policies. So we wanted to see whether our subjects would end up perhaps buying from a slightly more expensive merchant, but also a more privacy-protective merchant. So constructing good economic incentives was critical. So we gave our subjects a fixed payment, $45, for participating in the study. And they told them that they had to use this part of this money to purchase goods, as indicated during the study, which means that the subjects had an incentive to go to the least expensive merchants, because the lowest price they would choose, they would pay for a good, the more cash they would keep for themselves at the end of the experiment. So that created the economic incentive. In addition to that, we split the payment of these $45 in two different sessions, $10 immediately, and then the rest only after the subject had shown that they actually received the good they purchased. And we did so in order to prevent cheating and gaming of our experimental design.
One of the things that would make me uncomfortable participating in an experiment was you asked people to use their own credit cards. You also asked them to buy two products, one neutral and one not neutral. What were the two products that you asked them to purchase?
I guess that by neutral you're referring to the batteries.
Yes, indeed.
Not neutral, you're referring to the sex toy.
Right.
So we chose something that basically we were interested in two different types of concerns and whether people would react more to one or the other. A first concern is indeed about using your credit card and giving your personal and financial information to a new merchant you never did any business with before. Another concern is about connecting your name to certain specific items, so that the neutral good, the batteries, embody the first type of concern. The other good, the sex toy, embodied both the first concern, using your financial information with a new merchant, but also the second concern, buying something which some people may be embarrassed to associate their name with.
How uncomfortable were your participants about using their own credit cards to purchase sex toys online? Did you have a hard time getting enough people to participate?
To the best of my recollection, only one or two subjects were so uncomfortable that they decided not to continue with the study. All the other subjects continued, and as we could infer from the results, if they had concerns, if they were uncomfortable, they expressed so by choosing more privacy-protective measures.
Why did you need to pick both a neutral product like Duracell batteries and a product that, like the sex toys?
We were wondering whether our subjects would react more strongly to one or the other. under this story I mentioned to you a couple of minutes ago, that certain concerns are independent of the product you are purchasing, because it's simply about revealing financial information to a new merchant, and other concerns instead are related to exactly what we are buying. So we chose two different items in order to see whether the concerns will be stronger in one case over the other.
So now let's move on to the level of conclusions. And going back to the crux of your research, plain language, what were your main hypotheses and which of them were confirmed?
Well, the very short story is that we did find that people will pay for privacy under certain conditions. So when the differences between the privacy policies of different merchants are made very salient and therefore very accessible and easy to use to infer from the consumers, a significant number of consumers chooses to go to more privacy-protective merchants, even if this implies a slightly higher price. In our case, the prices were maybe higher for the most privacy-protective merchants by maybe 40, 50 cents. So a small privacy premium, as we call it, but a statistically significant privacy premium nevertheless.
What do these findings mean, both for online merchants and for consumers?
Well, for online merchants, I would say one of the implications is that providing more privacy to consumers can indeed be a strategy to differentiate themselves from the competition, a strategy to, in fact, even increase profits. For consumers, it means that we do have sometimes the power, we may have perhaps the power of influencing what kind of privacy policies merchants are going to offer us, because as more consumers realize the power they have when they are making choices online in terms of which merchant to buy from, we may force more merchants to be more protective of our data when we buy online.
And that's a reassuring message, considering how much, as we were saying earlier, we put our whole lives online for people to observe, something we wouldn't have done in the pre-internet age.
Yes, of course, I would not be an academic researcher if I didn't point out that there is also the caveats, the limitations. What I mean is that, consider just what is happening nowadays in the web2all online social network space. You have on one side a very successful company such as Facebook, which has violated the user's privacy repeatedly, but is still incredibly successful. On the other side, and this is very recent news, at least at the time when we are recording this podcast, you have Google, who tries to re-enter the online social network space by providing a new social network called Google+, which differentiates itself from Facebook by being more privacy conscious, more privacy protected. So what I mean is that in reality we find evidence in the marketplace both of companies who try to go for more and more data exploitation, as well as some companies who try to differentiate themselves in terms of privacy by maybe offering more privacy. The jury is out in the long term in terms of which strategy will be the winning one.
We only have time for one more question, and that is, what future research lies ahead for those concerned about privacy in the Internet?
Well, this is the million-dollar question, in the sense that there is definitely no shortage of interesting questions in the privacy space right now. In a way, to me, one of the most interesting issues, and this issue combines economics with behavioral decision research, with marketing, and with information systems research, of course, is in the long run, do consumers get more and more adjusted to privacy invasions, or in the long run, they eventually become so annoyed with privacy invasions, they will react. At the same time, there is also the trend we just discussed a few seconds ago of whether companies who provide more privacy will be successful against companies who violate more privacy. And to me, the interaction of these two trends, which type of companies will succeed and how consumers in the long run will react to privacy invasions, the interaction of these two trends will determine, in a way, what kind of society, not just what kind of electronic commerce, but really what kind of society we will live in 10, 20, 30 years from now.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Dr. Alessandro Acquisti of Carnegie Mellon University's Heinz College. Professor, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.